We commit passive violence all the time, every day, consciously and unconsciously. And that generates anger in the victim, and the victim then resorts to physical violence to get justice. So it is passive violence that fuels the fire of physical violence. So logically, if we want to put out that fire of physical violence, we have to cut off the fuel supply. And since the fuel supply comes from each one of us, we have to become the change we wish to see in the world. If we don't change our attitudes and our behavior and our relationships, we will never be able to create peace in this world.
That's Arun Gandhi, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Arun Gandhi on Gandhian Nonviolence Today. As protests and demonstrations continue around the world, once again the relevance of the strategies and tactics of civil disobedience and nonviolent resistance arise. What are we to do when faced with injustice? Look away or resist? Are sit-ins, blockades, and boycotts viable tools of resistance? Do people risk arrest and incarceration? Henry David Thoreau, who was an influence on Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., went to jail for refusing to pay taxes. He was a principled opponent to slavery and the U.S. war on Mexico. As the story goes, his friend, Ralph Waldo Emerson, visited him in jail. Emerson asked Thoreau, "What are you doing in there?" To which Thoreau replied, "What are you doing out there?" Going against power is not easy. Gandhi, who went to jail many times, said, "Nonviolence is a weapon of the strong." Our guest today is Arun Gandhi. He's the grandson of India's apostle of nonviolence, Mahatma Gandhi. In 1991, Arun Gandhi and his wife Sunanda founded the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, now located in Rochester, New York. A journalist, activist, and author, he lectures all over the world. He spoke at Lane Community College in Eugene, Oregon. And now, Arun Gandhi.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening to share with all of you a little that I know about the philosophy of nonviolence, things that I learned from my grandfather as a little boy at the age of 12. I lived with him for 2 years, and he taught me some very important lessons. And I want to share those lessons with you. The whole world is going through very tumultuous times right now. Everywhere the right-wing people, the ultra-right-wing people are getting elected to power, and they are destroying everything that we took so long to build, integrating our societies, bringing about peace in societies and better understanding between people. All of this is being very systematically eroded. We in India, they elected a very right-wing government who is also a very religious Hindu government, whose ultimate objective is to make India a Hindu nation. But they've also started a very systematic and a very well-planned attack on Gandhi. And they've started portraying him as a racist. I thought I would talk about this racism issue because I have noticed that they've started the campaign here in the United States. And they started spreading the word among the African-American people in the United States that Gandhi was a racist and he doesn't deserve to be held in esteem and certainly not linked with Dr. Martin Luther King. And this I learned very strangely, the first time I heard about this was when I boarded a plane, Delta airplane, to fly somewhere, and the flight attendant was an African American, and she saw my name on the manifest, and she came up to me and she said, "Are you related to Gandhi?" And I said, "Yes, I am his grandson." And she said, "I heard that he's a racist. He was a racist. And is that true?" And since then, many others have come and asked me the same question. And I want to share with you, and I told her, I said, yes, he was. I wouldn't say that he was a racist, but he was ignorant. A racist implies that he believes in prejudices and makes it a part of his life. Gandhi didn't believe in prejudice, but he was ignorant to begin with. And when he went to South Africa as a young man, he was only 23 when he went as a lawyer to South Africa. And it was there that he heard everybody refer to the local African people as Kaffirs. And so in some of his writings, early writings, he referred to them by that term, not knowing that this is a derogatory term. And when he realized that it was a derogatory term, he stopped using it and changed his entire attitude and even apologized to some of the African leaders at the time. And so that is now being taken out of context. And he's been branded as a racist. And also that he didn't do anything in Africa for the African people, that he confined his work only to getting equal rights for the Indian people, but he didn't care about the African people, which is not true again, because he didn't incorporate the African people into the struggle, because the government of South Africa had so cleverly made all the laws different for each racial group. And there were no common laws that affected both the groups that could be used to start a protest movement. And also, he had just begun the practice of his philosophy of nonviolence. He himself at that time didn't know exactly how it's going to be implemented and how it will be affected there. He was experimenting with this as he went along. So it was difficult enough for him to convince his own people about the philosophy of nonviolence, let alone convincing a people who had never heard about this philosophy and for whom he was a person of a different culture altogether. So he thought that he should first experiment with his own people and then maybe think about using it for the African people. This was the background to the whole issue that has now been taken out of context to paint him as a racist. But what really impresses me, this is an indication that he was a very ordinary person, that he was a very ignorant person. He was like any of us at that age, ignorant and learning about things. In fact, he was so ignorant that he says in his autobiography he had to struggle to get through his high school examinations. And so he wasn't a very bright student. He was married at the age of 13. His bride also was 13 years old at the time. They started living together at the age of 16. Grandfather says at that age, he didn't know who was going to be the boss in that relationship, who was going to lay down the rules and enforce them. So he went to the library and got books on the subject, and all these books were written by male chauvinists, and all of them talked about how the husband should lay down the rules and enforce them strictly. So after reading this, he came home one evening and he told grandmother, he said, from tomorrow you're not going to step out of the house without my permission. That is the law and you're going to observe it, and I want no arguments about it. And grandmother quietly heard him and didn't retort or didn't say anything. She just turned around and went to bed, got up the next day, and she continued to do what she always did. Went out and visited and never bothered to get his permission. So a few days later, when he realized that she wasn't obeying him, he confronted her again and he says, how dare you disobey me? Didn't I tell you that you are not to go out without my permission? And at that point, very quietly, grandmother says to him, says, I was brought up to believe that we must always obey the elders in the house. And I believe the elders in this house are your parents. If you are now trying to tell me that I should not obey your mother, but obey you instead, let me know so that I can go and tell your mother I'm not going to obey you anymore. And of course, he couldn't tell her to do that. And so the whole matter was settled without anybody getting angry and raising an issue and even maybe, you know, breaking up a relationship there. So he says in his autobiography that that was the most profound lesson in nonviolent conflict resolution that he learned at that age. How to understand anger and use that constructively and intelligently. That became the cornerstone of his philosophy of nonviolence. Everybody who came to participate in his struggle, they were first taught this lesson about understanding anger and being able to keep it under check and use the emotion and the energy generated by it constructively. That was the lesson I was taught when I came to him from South Africa after the prejudices that I suffered, the physical beatings and so on. And he explained to me that anger is like electricity. It's just as useful and just as powerful, but only if we use it intelligently. But it can be just as deadly and destructive if we abuse it. So just as we channel electrical energy into our lives and use it for the good of humanity, we must learn to channel anger in the same way so that we can use that energy for the good of humanity rather than abuse it and cause death and destruction. He suggested that I write an anger journal. He said, every time you get angry, don't act on it, don't say anything or do anything that you're going to regret later on. But write a journal. But write the journal with the intention of finding a solution to the problem. And then commit yourself to finding a solution. Now that is very important. Because a lot of people today tell me they've been writing an anger journal for a long time, but it hasn't really helped them. Because every time they go back and read the journal, they're just reminded of the incident and they get angry all over again. So we don't want the journal to be a reminder of the incident. We want the journal to help us find a solution to the problem. I did this for many years, and I must say it helped me considerably in learning how to deal with anger and use that energy constructively and intelligently. But after learning this profound lesson from him, I was just 12 years old at the time, and I decided to test him and see whether he himself had learned the lesson or not. This was the time in his life when he was involved in many important things, not just the freedom of India, but he was concerned about the emancipation of the Indian women, the education of the children, the emancipation of the so-called untouchable people. All of these were very important to him, and he had programs going on in all these different fields. And all these programs needed funding. And he realized that the easiest way for him to raise the money was to sell his autograph. And he put a fee of 5 rupees for each autograph, which in today's currency would be approximately 10 cents, 15 cents. And every morning and evening, when thousands of people would assemble for his interfaith prayer services, they would, most of them would seek his autograph. And it was my duty while I lived with him to go out into the audience and collect the books and the money and bring it to him for his signature. And one day I thought to myself, if everybody could get his autograph, why not me? After all, I'm his grandson and I deserve an autograph too. But I didn't have any money, so I got myself a little autograph book and I slipped it into the pile, hoping that he wouldn't notice the absence of money there. But when he came to that book, he said, "Why is there no money for this autograph?" And I said, "Because it's my book." And he said, "Well, you should know that I don't make an exception even for grandsons. That if you want an autograph, you'll not only have to pay me for it, but you'll have to earn the money and pay me. Don't ask your parents for it." And I said, "No way." He said, "You are my grandfather, and I'm going to make you give me this autograph free." So he laughed and said, "All right, let's see who wins." And from that day, every day, when he was in high-level political discussions with British politicians or Indian politicians, I would barge into the room and thrust my book in his face and demand an autograph. My logic was that just to get rid of me, he would sign the book and give it to me. But instead, every time I became too boisterous, all he did was put his hands across my mouth, press my head against his chest, and went on talking politics. On many occasions, the other politicians used to get exasperated and tell Grandfather, "Why don't you give him the autograph? He disturbs our meetings every day." And Grandfather would just smile and say, "This is a private joke between the two of us. You don't have to get involved in it." Well, the long and short of it is that he never did give me the autograph. But he never ever told me to get out of the room and leave him alone, as we do with our children or our siblings. If they come into the room when we are busy with something, we shoo them out very rudely, tell them, "Get out, can't you see I'm busy just now?" He never ever did that to me. And that's when I realized that if he could control his anger to that extent, if we can attempt achieve 50% of it, we will make a tremendous difference in the level of violence that we experience today. Harvard University has recently did a study, and they came to the conclusion that more than 85% of the violence that we experience in our lives today is generated by anger. So imagine if we can reduce that by 50%, how much a difference it would make in the level of violence that we are experiencing. So it's anger that we need to understand and deal with. We don't need to be ashamed of it. We don't need to deny it. What we need to do is to be ashamed of the way we abuse it and learn to channel that energy constructively and intelligently. But the other lesson also is a very profound lesson, which happened when I was coming back from school and I had a little butt of a pencil in my hands and I thought I deserved a better pencil. And without a second thought, I threw the pencil away because I was so sure Grandfather would give me a new pencil when I asked him for one. But that evening when I met Grandfather and asked him for a new pencil, instead of giving me one, he subjected me to a lot of questions. He wanted to know how the pencil became small and where did I throw it away and why did I throw it away and on and on and on. And I couldn't understand why he was making such a fuss over a little pencil until he told me to go out and look for it. And I said, "You must be joking." He said, "You don't expect me to look for a little pencil in the dark?" He said, "Oh yes, I do. Here's a flashlight." And he sent me out with the flashlight, and I think I must have spent something like 2 hours searching for it. And when I finally found it and brought it to him, he said, "Now I want you to sit here and learn two very important lessons. The first lesson is that even in the making of a simple thing like a pencil, we use a lot of the world's natural resources. And when we throw them away, we are throwing away the world's natural resources, and that is violence against nature. And the second lesson is that because in an affluent society we can afford to buy all these things in bulk, we overconsume the resources of the world, and because we overconsume them, we are depriving people elsewhere of these resources, and they have to live in poverty. And that is violence against humanity." And that was the first time I realized that all of these little things that we do every day, things that have become so much a part of our nature that we don't even realize it's a form of violence. Everything that we waste and throw away and overconsume and destroy, all of that is an act of violence. The discrimination, the oppression, suppression, all of these things are acts of violence. So violence is not just wars and physical beatings and so on, but violence is the way we live and the amount of consumption that we incur in our lives. To make me understand this thoroughly, he made me draw a genealogical tree of violence, just as we would do a family tree, with violence as the grandparent and physical violence and passive violence as the two branches. And every day before I went to bed, I had to analyze and examine everything that I had done to other people or people may have done to me or things that I may have experienced. Everything had to be analyzed and put in their appropriate places on that tree. If it was the kind of violence where physical force was used, that would go under physical violence. But if it's the kind of violence where we don't use any force at all, and yet we hurt people, that would be passive violence. And the way I had to determine this was to ask myself the simple question, if somebody were to do this to me, would I be hurt by it or would I be helped by it? And if I came to the conclusion that it would hurt me, then that would be passive violence. And that could be so many things that we do every day in our lives. When I began to do this introspection, I was amazed that within a few months I was able to fill up a whole wall in my room with acts of passive violence. The physical violence didn't grow very much because there's a limit to what you can do. But the passive violences grew endlessly. And then Grandfather explained to me the connection between the two. He said, we commit passive violence all the time, every day, consciously and unconsciously. And that generates anger in the victim, and the victim then resorts to physical violence to get justice. So it is passive violence that fuels the fire of physical violence, So logically, if we want to put out that fire of physical violence, we have to cut off the fuel supply. And since the fuel supply comes from each one of us, we have to become the change we wish to see in the world. If we don't change our attitudes and our behavior and our relationships, we will never be able to create peace in this world. And that kind of relationship is also a very important thing. Because in the culture of violence that we have created today in the world, a culture of violence that dominates every aspect of our life, our language, our entertainment, our sports, our relationships with each other, everything is based on the culture of violence. And in that culture of violence, our relationships are built on the principles of self-interest. We are constantly thinking about what am I going to gain from this relationship, and if I don't gain anything from it, why should I bother to have a relationship? So every time we break a relationship, we are creating the potential for a conflict. So building relationships on the principles of nonviolence requires that our relationships are based on respect, understanding, acceptance, and appreciation. We have to respect ourselves and respect each other and respect our connection with all of creation. And that is very important, because people today are told that we are independent individuals and we can do whatever we like and it's nobody's business. We are not independent individuals. We are interdependent, interconnected, and interrelated. It's only when we respect that, that we will understand who we are and what we are and why are we here on earth. We are not here by accident. We are not here to while away our time from birth to death. We are all here for a purpose. And at the very least, the purpose that we have in our life is to make this world or make this society in which we live a little better by our existence than we found it before us. So that is the purpose of our life. And when we understand that, then we will be able to accept each other as human beings, not identify people by the labels we have put upon ourselves. Today we have so many labels to identify people that we have forgotten that behind those labels there is a human being. There are gender labels and race labels and color labels and religious labels and economic labels. You name it and we have a label. So every time we put a label on somebody, we are building a wall between that person and us. And every time we build a wall between people, we are creating the potential for a conflict. So we've got to remove all those labels and just learn to accept each other as human beings and respect each other as human beings. And it's only when we are able to do that that we will appreciate our own humanity. That is how we build relationships in a culture of nonviolence. So these are aspects of his philosophy of nonviolence that have not been talked about very much. We have always looked at his philosophy only as a way of resolving conflicts or resolving wars and so on. But it's very important for us to remember that his philosophy is more about transforming the personality rather than just learning to resolve conflicts. If we don't transform ourselves and change our habits and change the culture of violence that we have created around us, we will never be able to work for peace or create peace. We have to be at peace ourselves, within ourselves, to be able to create peace outside. We cannot create something that we cannot create for ourselves.
You're listening to Arun Gandhi on Gandhian Nonviolence Today. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
I want to conclude now with one final story that my grandfather used to be very fond of telling us. The story of an ancient Indian king who once became very curious about the meaning of peace. And he invited all the intellectuals in his kingdom to come and explain the meaning of peace. And everybody came there and did their best, but nobody could satisfy the king. And then one day there was an intellectual from another town who came on a visit, and the king asked him to explain the meaning of peace. And he said, the only person who can give you a satisfactory answer is an old sage who lives outside your kingdom. But he is so old that he cannot come to you. You will have to go to him and ask him this question. So the next day the king went to the sage and asked him the meaning of peace. And the sage quietly went to the back of the house, came back with a grain of wheat, and placed that grain of wheat on the king's palm and said, here is your answer. And of course the king didn't know what a grain of wheat had to do with peace, and he didn't want to show his ignorance. So he quietly clutched that grain of wheat and went back to his palace, found a little gold box, and he placed that grain of wheat in the box. And every morning he would open the box to look for an answer, and he couldn't find any answers. So a few days later, when this intellectual came back on a return visit, the king asked him to explain. He said, you sent me to this sage and he gave me this grain of wheat, and I don't know what this grain of wheat has to do with peace, so please explain. And that's when the intellectual said, it's very simple. He said, as long as you keep this grain of wheat in this box, nothing is going to happen. It will eventually rot and perish, and that will be the end of the story. But if you had allowed this grain of wheat to interact with all the elements, if you had planted this outside in the soil, it would sprout and grow, and very soon you could have a whole field of wheat. And that is the meaning of peace. If somebody has found peace and if they keep it locked up in their hearts, it will perish with them. But if they let it interact with all the elements, it would sprout and grow, and very soon we could have a whole world of peacemakers. So I have come here this evening to give you the grain of wheat that I got from my grandfather, and I hope that you won't let it rot and perish, but let it interact with all the elements so that all of us together can make this world a better place for future generations. Thank you.
Our country, the United States, has invaded many countries since World War II, and none of those wars were self-defense. We killed several million people in the Korean War, and in the Vietnam War again, and then in the Persian Gulf. What are the causes of these wars? And I seem to have a different theory that they're not caused by anything that we can rectify by making ourselves better, but they're caused by psychopathic leaders of our country who organize and maintain the large institutions of the country. So could you help me out on that, understanding that?
Yes, certainly, I do agree with you. It's caused mainly by our military-industrial complex. You know, we manufacture 60% of the world's armaments, and if we are manufacturing all of those armaments, somebody has got to use them. Otherwise, how do we stockpile all these things for years to come? And we've invested so much in that industry that we can't allow it to fade away. And they've been so clever in the way they built this industry. They have these armament industries in every state of the union. And they employ a lot of people. So the moment anybody talks about closing down any of the armaments, they raise the fear of unemployment, and everybody gets so hurt by it that they don't want it to stop. And so we participate in the manufacture of this very potent thing, which causes all the evil in the world there. So it is a kind of a Frankenstein monster that we have built, which ultimately is going to destroy us.
I'm wondering what your opinion is of why we have so many right-wing governments rising up throughout the world.
I think it is largely our own fault, those who believe in peace and who believe in equality of everybody. We got so caught up in our own programs that we have forgotten there were many people who were hurting, people who had lost their jobs and factories that had to be closed down, and millions of people were without jobs and they were hurting very badly, and we didn't do anything about them. We didn't, you know, step in to help them in any way, and so they expressed their anger by voting out the liberal parties and bringing in the right-wing parties. Mm-hmm. It was more of a negative vote, not that they believed in the right-wing theory, but their belief is they just want to destroy the existing structure, and anybody who can destroy it is welcome.
So do you see a remedy for that? What is our actions that we can take as...
I think it is time that we took note of the pain of the people and people who live among ourselves who are in distress, and see how best we can help them, you know, regain some control over their lives. We can establish several little programs and inspire people to do things. You know, we don't always have to depend on the government to do everything. We as people can do things too. And one of the things that I do as part of my program is take a Gandhi legacy tour every year to India. And we have identified some 10 programs where individuals have started something that has now grown into helping millions of people. And it, so, you know, it's kind of an inspiration for people that one person can do great things, that we don't have to wait for, you know, many people to come into the field.
I'm curious how you can instill peace in yourself and to instill it in others.
Well, we can instill peace in ourselves by self-analysis. We have to stop becoming consumers. You know, we get trapped in materialism and we want to buy things and continuously buy, and therefore we need to have more money, and we work harder to get more money, and that whole cycle goes on. And before we realize it, we have spent so much of our life chasing after money and products that we have forgotten to live and forgotten to build relationships. So we have to come to an understanding that how far are we going to go with money and possessions, and how much of our life are we going to spend in building relationships with each other and our families and our children and so on. And so that is one of the ways in which we can bring peace there. Because as long as we keep chasing after products, we are never going to be at peace.
I'm just wondering how there could be a balance between kind of doing that introspection and finding internal peace, while also, like, in these times there's a lot of protests, there's a lot of world issues. while still keeping that in mind? Because sometimes I'm worried that I'm not, like, I don't have my personal development up to the level that I could really be productive in, like, a protest, per se, or something like that. So I'm just wondering how you would go about balancing your personal growth and well-being and also the growth of other people. And
personal growth is an ongoing thing. We never reach perfection. We are constantly growing, we are constantly learning, constantly changing, because times change, circumstances change, everything keeps changing, and we have to continuously change along with that. So if we wait till we reach perfection to do anything, then we won't do anything at all. We have to continuously keep changing and at the same time continuously be active and not accept injustice anyway.
This is in regards to passive violence. With the increase in propaganda efforts of the administration and his party, or as some call it, the fake news, more and more people aren't even aware that they're suffering from passive violence. What ways can we use to educate people about passive violence and maybe harness that passive violence that people are suffering and use it for good?
Well, now that I've explained to you the passive violence, I hope you will go and explain to others and spread the word. And, you know, that's the purpose of my coming and planting the seeds. I'm hoping that you will carry on with the same thing. And
I suppose I should be more specific. Sometimes in people that believe things very strongly that just aren't true, and they vote against their own interests time and time again, they're not as likely to listen to us the first time, and it takes some extra effort.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, in any situation, we are not going to accept anything on the first time when somebody comes and explains it. But we have to reflect on it, and we have to keep working on it and keep trying to explain to them. And eventually, when they see the truth, they will accept it. But, you know, the first time you go there and explain, they'll be very suspicious of you and not accept it. But that doesn't mean that you give it up. You have to continue working on them.
Thank you. One of the things you mentioned was our interconnectedness as a species, and that we are not individuals, but rather parts of a whole. And one of my greatest frustrations is that people not only refuse to see that, but actually celebrate their refusal to see it and celebrate their individuality. What would you say that we can do to challenge this notion of supreme individuality and get them to open themselves up to how connected we actually are as a species?
Well, I think that's like I told the lady just now. We have to continue to work on that understanding, because for so many generations, people have been continuously told that you're individuals, you've got to stand up for what you want, and you know, and we do this very subtly all the time. Even as parents, when we are teaching our children, we teach them that they have to be successful in life, they have to get to the top, don't worry about other people, you get to the top there by any means possible. So we instill that kind of sense in everybody. And if we stop doing that at our family level, eventually generations will grow up realizing that we are all in it together, and we can't trample each other to get to the top.
I'm a student activist at the University of Oregon, and I also keep or try to keep a spiritual practice. And part of that is recognizing the divinity in every human being, seeing everybody as an incarnation of God, so to speak. But I've really been, my spiritual life and my activist life have really been kind of at odds, in that it's really hard to see someone like Hitler or someone like a neo-Nazi as an incarnation of God. And I guess my question is more like, How does that work? Am I not yogiing hard enough? Do I need to meditate more?
Well, you know, this is a difficult thing. I mean, we have to continuously work on it. Even grandfather, although by the time he reached his age when I met him, he had learned a lot and practiced a lot, but he continuously said that I still have very negative thoughts about very many things, and I have to continuously work on transforming them. So we have to continuously work also. We've gotten so used to, in the culture of violence, to focus on the person instead of the problem. At every level, we see this even in our crime situation. We catch the thief and we lock them up in prison and we think that we have done the good deed. But we haven't focused on the problem. What made that person commit the crime? What were the circumstances that impelled that person to commit the crime? We never go into the problem. We just catch people and lock them up. And that's become our whole way of life. So when we see dictators like Hitler and others, we think, well, destroy them and we'll get rid of all the hate. But what happened? We destroyed Hitler, we sacrificed 70 million lives in destroying Nazism, but that hate of Nazi philosophy still continues and still threatens us because we didn't pay any attention to the problem. We just focused on eliminating the person. So we have to try to work on eliminating that kind of attitude within us and begin to look more at the problem and see how can we get rid of the hate and prejudice that people are prone to rather than eliminating the person.
I'm 15 years old and I go to South Eugene High School. And I was just wondering, as a young person, I tend to notice that we are taken a little less seriously than adults. So I was wondering exactly how we can make change while still being nonviolent and still being heard in this community.
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, people tend to take other people very less seriously. Even I am not taken very seriously often. So you're not the only one. But we have, if we believe in something, then we have to persist in it and convince people why we are right. And, you know, I don't think you should be discouraged because, like, the whole recycling business was started by young people. It was only when young people like you got into the act of recycling that the older people realized the importance of it, and now everybody has gotten into recycling things. So it's, you know, sometimes it happens, but we have to persist. It's not like you can come and say, yes, you have to do this and everybody is going to accept it. It takes a lot of energy to make people realize what they need to do.
We're living in a real divided country right now after our elections. And I know a way that I've been passively violent and judgmental towards people who are Republicans and Trump supporters, and I see a lot of people that I know being that way. And I wonder how you think that I can reconcile that in myself and us as a country when there's so much, really, I feel superior sometimes, judgmental, and that sort of thing. And really, in some ways, like what you were saying, it's an act of violence against those people to discredit them and think that they're, you know, they don't care about peace as much as me, so I'm better than them or something like that. So I wonder what your recommendation for me would be.
Well, it's quite natural for people to feel very strongly about what they believe in. Just as you feel strongly about what you believe in, I'm sure they feel equally strongly about what they believe in. Mm-hmm. And if it is possible at all, and if you have a friendly relationship with people like those who support Trump, I would suggest having a friendly dialogue with them. Try to find out from them what is it that makes them support him and what are his policies that attract him, them so much. In what I've been able to discover, and I may be wrong in this, but for the few people that I have talked to, I've discovered that they don't really believe in him and his philosophy. They just believe that he is going to be destructive and destroy the establishment in Washington, and that's all they want. They want that establishment to be destroyed. And they're so angry about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you can have a dialogue with them, by all means have a dialogue with them. But if you can't, then try to understand in other ways mm-hmm. where they come from and respect them for their beliefs.
My question is about, as a young individual growing up, when your grandfather died, and as you developed and you kind of saw the state of the world more, did you experience things like hopelessness or despair or feeling like, what can I do to make a difference? Because those are my questions that I ask myself. And
yes, I've gone through all of those things.
What? How did you, you know, kind of come to a place where?
Well, in the beginning, of course, it was my parents who helped me. Whenever I felt despair, they told me that you have to just continuously persist and work on it and don't give up hope. And then as I grew up and when I lost my parents, I had to just keep reminding myself what they told me and what my grandfather told me. And I said, I can't afford to give up hope. I have to continue to work because a lot depends. And that's why I call myself a peace farmer. I go out and plant seeds everywhere, and I hope that those seeds germinate and I get a good crop.
Just like your parents in Gandhi planted those seeds in you.
So I just go on. And sometimes, you know, when, like the night when Trump was elected into power, and I went to bed so sure that he was not going to win the election. In the middle of the night, my grandson woke me up from India and said, you better think of coming back to India. I said, why? He said, don't you know Trump has won the election? And I felt hopeless at that moment. And I said, what have we done and what are we ending up in? But then, because of the training I had and the messages that I had, I realized that giving in to hopelessness is not right. We have to continue to work.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Arun Gandhi on Gandhian Nonviolence Today. He spoke at Lane Community College in Eugene, Oregon. Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma, is the founder of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester, New York. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Vandana Shiva, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Angela Davis, Arundhati Roy, Bill McKibben, Ralph Nader, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Matt Laubeck recorded the program. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.